From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. It is no coincidence that during a time of changing climate, wealth inequality, and a global pandemic, that large masses of humans would leave their homes, escaping danger and death, and looking for a better life. Indeed, it is only natural to migrate, as non-human species do, who do not have to contend with artificial borders, xenophobic leaders, or racist scapegoating. Throughout history, animals, plants, and humans have migrated to avoid danger to their species. And telling that story in a new book is acclaimed science journalist Sonia Shah. Her earlier book was titled Pandemic: Tracking Contagion from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond. She now joins me to discuss her newest book, The Next Great Migration: The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. Welcome to the program, Sonia.
Thanks for having me.
So the next great migration is something that we are already in the middle of, or something that you are expecting to happen?
Yeah, I think it's already starting. We have about 80% of wild species have shifted their ranges. They're moving towards the poles and up into higher altitudes to in sync with the changing climate. People are moving in new ways too. We have more people who are living in countries outside of the countries they were born in than ever before. We have more displaced people than at any time since World War II. And these changed migration patterns are likely to continue and deepen as the climate crisis unfolds.
So what do we know about the history of migration of species? This is, I imagine, a really interesting scientific field to be in that might draw from many different fields, such as archaeology, et cetera. What are some of the earliest known migrations?
Well, the earliest one for us, of course, was our walk out of Africa. But what we now understand, only in the last few years, that once we walked out of Africa and populated the continents of the planet, we didn't stop moving. We kept moving even after that. In ancient times, people who walked out of Africa and into the Americas walked back into parts of Asia and Europe. People in Asia walked into Europe and back to Africa. So the whole process of migration that happened in our ancient past is just now being uncovered, and we're just starting to learn about that history. But what it does show is a history of continuous migration. I think we have this conventional idea that humans kind of walked out of Africa and then stayed still for millennia until this modern moment of migration made possible by modern navigational technology and, you know, fast shipping and planes and all of that. But in fact, we were moving all along, including into some of the most forbidding habitats on the planet, the heights of the Tibetan Plateau, the most remote islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So I think a whole new picture of the role of migration in the human past is now emerging. And we're also learning a lot more about the scale of mobility and migration in wild species as well, thanks to new technology like GPS and solar tags, which has allowed scientists to track wild species like throughout their ranges. And it turns out they move a lot farther, a lot faster, in a lot more complex and meaningful ways than scientists had ever before believed.
What are the reasons for migration historically of both humans and non-human species? I imagine that a lot of it is simply related to access to the resources you need in order to survive.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think even asking why for a singular reason is in the end sort of reductive. We're talking about a very complex behavior that has played a huge and central role in our survival on this changing planet. It's been critical to the resilience of human societies. It's been critical to whole ecosystems, which depend on the movement of animals to create biodiversity. So, you know, I don't think we can come up with a single reason. I think one of the explanations for why we always search for that single reason is because we think of migration as sort of exceptional and rare and marginal and something that needs to be explained, but in fact is very much in the center of our experience as a species on this planet historically.
That, of course, raises a lot of questions about things like ancestry, tradition, heritage. As you said, we have the simplistic notion of our own history. But if human history is rife with migratory patterns, we move from one space to another, that idea that we are all part of, you know, one great human family, as silly as it may sound, or as idealistic as it may sound, might actually have a lot of basis in truth, right? I mean, and you can only really trace your ancestry back down to a few generations before things get mixed up.
Exactly. So, you know, when we talk about where we're from and where we belong, we're really talking about a snapshot in time. It's a moment that we sort of ascribe a lot of explanatory power to. But in fact, you're right, we've been moving all along. And so most of us have an active long distance migration in our very recent ancestry, just in a few generations, if not less than that. And so, you know, there's a process in history where we move into new places and we adapt to those new places and we differentiate a little bit, but then we start moving again and reincorporate and integrate into new places. So that process of, you know, differentiating and then coming back together again is how we have preserved diversity among our societies, and yet also at the same time maintained, you know, a single human family, which is what we are.
You write in your book, The Next Great Migration, about a geographical aspect called the Darien Gap, which I have to confess I'd never heard of. Tell me what this is and how it figures into the story of our migration.
So there's a single road that actually goes from the very end of Alaska all the way through the United States, down through Central America and to the tip of South America, called the Pan American Highway. It's a complete one route, except for in one part of Panama, in this part of Panama that's very thickly forested called the Darien. And so because that jungle has prevented this road from continuing, it's called the Darien Gap. And so what has happened in recent years, because it's so difficult, we've made it so difficult for people to move around across international borders, that migrants have been very resourceful and they find new ways to get to new places. And we see a lot of people who are coming over from Caribbean, from Asia, from parts of Africa, coming into South America and actually walking through the Darien Gap to get to the U.S. border and to the Canadian border as well. And it's an incredibly, you know, circuitous and dangerous and fraught journey. It's the kind of thing, when you go through the Darien Gap, it's the kind of thing that, you know, if you were sort of an expeditionist, you would prepare for months, and you'd have all the latest, you know, gear and GPS and satellite and all of that. And these are people who are coming there with their babies on their hips, wearing flip-flops, and they are walking through this incredibly dangerous forest. Many die falling into the rivers, die of dehydration, are also accosted by like criminal gangs that have taken cover in there. And the fact that this continues is just a testament to how strong the migratory instinct is and how much these people need to move to get to places where they can make a good life for themselves.
The reasons for our current migration that we're in, that we started talking about, as far as you can tell, and I'm talking about human migration here, are those in any way different from previous human migrations?
I think what's different now is the pace. So we can move a lot faster. But there's still a lot of migration that we just don't track right now. You know, there's certain migratory flows that we pay outsized attention to, for example, asylum seekers who are coming to the U.S.-Mexico border, or people from Syria who are trying to get into Germany and who are drowning in the Mediterranean Sea. So there's certain migratory flows that we really focus our attention on. But what we don't see is all of the mobility that's happening all around us all the time. It's, you know, we don't track it very well, and we're not really even aware of it. It's sort of like the blood pulsing through our veins. You know, it happens beneath our notice. I think we saw this in stark contrast during this pandemic, when you know, we had this, the virus came up in Wuhan, and the city shut down eventually. And then all the, so many policymakers around the world said, okay, well, we're just going to close our borders to China and Wuhan. And, you know, okay, that's it. We're done. We'll be safe now. Well, it turned out 7 million people had already left the city of Wuhan. Thousands of people were carrying the virus, had already arrived in Europe, and were pouring into the United States across this country, because there's so much mobility going on that we just are not aware of, and we're not even tracking it that well.
Well, speaking of that, there has been a lot of fodder for xenophobic leaders like President Trump and the UK's Boris Johnson and Hungary's leader, etc., to say that that migration is the cause of epidemics spreading, disease spreading. I imagine that past human migration also came with such accusations. What did you find in your research about whether those assertions are true?
Well, it's very interesting because, you know, I've been reporting on infectious diseases for a long time. And so when I first started writing about migration, I went to Greece to report on migrants who were arriving there from Syria and Afghanistan. And my thinking at that time was that this was a public health risk. I mean, this is what a lot of leaders were saying at the time. And it seemed to me a reasonable presumption that perhaps it was. Well, what I learned is that, in fact, migrants are healthier than the host populations they join. And that's a very well-documented, widespread outcome that's called the healthy migrant effect. And, you know, when you think about it even for a minute, it's clear why, which is that migration itself requires health. It requires resilience. It requires sort of skills and social contacts and education, the kind of mobile capital that people can take with them. You know, so you don't see a lot of migration happening among the very poorest of the poor, because it does take some resources to move, but you also don't see migrants being the very wealthiest either, because you know, you can't take your titles and your property with you. So it's people who have a lot of mobile capital, and that includes good health. So a lot of the stereotypes we have about migrants and the disruptions they cause, you know, I had them too when I started doing this research. And even though I'm, you know, not in any way a xenophobic, I still did believe that migration was disruptive and anomalous and could cause problems. And when I looked into all of the different explanations for why that is, the economic impact, security impact, health impact, I found that none of it was really true. And a lot of it had been blown out of proportion.
Right. So in addition to the myth around migrants spreading disease simply by virtue of moving, there's also this idea that they are taking away from resources available to the population that they migrate to, that there's this competition for resources. Is this just the sort of capitalist mindset, mythical mindset, that there's a limited pie of what's available and we don't want to, there's not a slice available to share with incoming migrants?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think part of it is that zero sum sort of idea that like the economy is something very fixed and it doesn't grow, which of course we know is not true. This is not to say that, you know, migratory flows don't cause disruptions and don't have any cost to them. They do. But the long-term benefits are outweighed by those short-term costs. So even when there are in certain places when a flow of migrants might cost more to that society in terms of needing to create more capacity for schools, for jobs, for social services, all of that, it's greatly outweighed if you just wait a generation or two. The next generation pays back that investment, and the generation after that actually makes, you know, brings an economic benefit to them. So it all really depends on the time scale we look at this in. You know, migration is in an economic sense, it's an investment, because you do have the short-term costs sometimes, but you have these huge long-term benefits. And that's why we've been doing it all along. You know, it's persisted in our history and our societies as a cultural practice, because it does, because the benefits do outweigh the risks at the end.
I want to go back to what we started discussing, which is that this notion that populations are static is so false. You and I are from India originally. We know in our home country, there's a massive variety in skin tones and hair textures, etc., features, facial features. The same is true in the European continent. And so is that a pretty strong evidence that unfortunately many of us don't want to see of a massive flux in humanity just probably a few generations back.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, when you look at human diversity, it's a range, it's a continuum. And the way we have sort of created borders between us, like as if Asians are all one kind of people, right? I mean, that incorporates very, you know, people with a huge variety of skin tones, from, you know, very light skinned people in Northern Asia to very dark skinned people in Southern India, people with all different varieties of hair, you know, hair, eyes, everything. We're so different. And, you know, those qualities overlap with people in Europe and in the Americas. So, you know, the way we've kind of divvied everybody up into these very like, separate categories. And in the past, we even thought of those as biological categories. And a lot of xenophobes today still do that. We still sort of give that idea credence when we talk about race as something more than just an arbitrary social concept. Of course, it has been, you know, underlined and emphasized with like decades of historical, you know, economic and policy making. But the actual underlying differences between us, you know, we can't adequately or consistently divide us into separate groups or subspecies or races. It just doesn't work. The edges between us are too fuzzy.
Right. Except, of course, white supremacists don't like to think so. There is no such thing as somebody who's absolutely white. There are people who look white who are white and people who look white who are not white and vice versa. You have in your book a chapter entitled Linnaeus's Loathsome Harlotry about Carl Linnaeus. Who was he? How does he figure into the story of the history of human migration?
So Carl Linnaeus was an 18th century Swedish naturalist, and he's considered today the father of modern taxonomy. So he was the one who sort of came up with the whole way we classify all the things in nature, all of the living things in nature, the plants, the animals, but also people. So he came up with a human taxonomy where he decided, okay, where does everybody belong? And what he laid out early on in the 18th century was that Africans belonged in Africa, Asians belonged in Asia, Europeans belonged in Europe, and Americans belonged in America. And he actually color-coded us so that Europeans were white, Americans were red, Asians were yellow, and Africans were black, and said that we were essentially subspecies, that we were, you know, he gave us different Latin names as if we were biologically isolated from each other. That was his thinking, that this was a hierarchy and we were separated by biological distinctions. And that idea, that human taxonomy that he came up with, was incorporated into eugenics and what was called race science in the early 20th century, that then led to Nazism and was incorporated into anti-immigrant sort of narratives and rhetoric to this day. And of course, very much reified in our modern ideas about race.
So there is, I know, a new book that's making the rounds by Isabel Wilkerson, who you open, one of her quotes is in the opening of your book. Her book is Caste, where she brings up her new book, brings up the comparisons between India's caste system, Germany's Nazism, etc. It seems as though the xenophobia that humans have unfortunately historically succumbed to are built into these myths that we have held on to. Is that, and I don't know if you cover this in your book, is that desire to scapegoat the other as human as the human desire to migrate?
Yes and no. I mean, I think there's a sense that xenophobia sort of emerges whenever two distinct cultures collide. And that's actually not true. So in most places, distinct people from distinctly different cultures and places live together or merge together. And it happens beneath our notice. And we don't really think or talk about it. It's only so social scientists have actually tracked this. They've looked at, well, when this community collided with this community moved into this other community or migrated into another place. It was, you know, did that result in a xenophobic backlash? And most of the time it doesn't. So really what we have to explain is why does xenophobic backlashes occur in the first place, right? Because it's not the norm. So it's actually a marginal phenomenon that we see that. And so there's no clear answer as to why. One of the theories that I explore in the book is the idea that sometimes migration becomes conspicuous. And that could be because the pace is rapid or the direction is something new, or, you know, just because of, you know, how policymaking is done around it. Like if you make everybody line up at the border, or you make everyone, you know, somehow conspicuous in your rhetoric or your policymaking, and then everyone kind of notices that. And that seems to be really critical to, you know, creating the xenophobic backlash. If you don't do that, if you let migration just sort of unfold in the background and don't draw too much attention to it, people assimilate really quickly. This is something that was very striking to me when I was doing the research for this, that, you know, social scientists actually tracked way back in the early 20th century that immigrants' bodies themselves start to change as soon as they get into a new place. We are such changelings. So wherever we migrate into, we start assimilating and integrated into that place almost immediately. And within a generation or two, any of the major indicators that social scientists would look at, fertility patterns, educational attainment, health outcomes, all of those things, they kind of congregate to the mean. So we become part of the society that we've entered. So migration is really something that happens without problems in most places. It's just the exceptional spots and historical moments when it becomes problematic. And I think what's happened today is we've had some conspicuous migratory flows, and then we've had a lot of populist right-wing leaders climb into power based on policymaking around that to say, you know, scaremonger people and sort of say, well, I'm going to take care of this problem that you can, you know, that I've sort of manufactured. And then they have to continuously justify why they're there by pointing to, you know, scapegoating migrants and saying they're going to build a wall, and all that becomes part of their sort of political program.
Incredible. So humans are quite adaptive. And if left alone, the migration just, you know, becomes part of who we are, unless you draw attention to it. And then xenophobic policymakers seem to generate xenophobia where there might not have been any or not very much of it before. It's quite remarkable to think about it. So I want to end by asking you a question about comparing human migration to non-human migration. Are some of the reasons, or are there links to be made between, you know, for example, the reasons why certain species of animals or insects, so birds or even plants and trees migrate, and why humans migrate? Can humans be part of that continuum of life and migration?
Personally, I don't see any reason why we would not be. But at the same time, social scientists who study humans and wildlife scientists who study wildlife are very, very reluctant to compare the two. I think because it's politically, you know, very sort of controversial to do that. But what we do know from wild migrations is that whole ecosystems depend on this, right? So there's whole ecosystems that depend on animals moving around in order to bring biodiversity, to bring new plant seeds. You know, their wild animals are critical in seed dispersal, the dispersal of different plant species around, which is the very, you know, scaffolding of ecosystems. So without those ties, that connective tissue that migrants create, a lot of our ecosystems would become quite fragile. We know that homogeneous societies, you know, if they happen to be well adapted to their present conditions, fine, they might do well. They might do well for a period of time, but conditions change. And I think that's the really underlying issue here, is that we live on a planet that is changing rapidly now, but it has always been changing. The way we have adapted to change is by migrating. That allows us to differentiate, allows us to bring diversity into new places. And when we have diversity, then we're much less vulnerable when some, you know, big, you know, calamity happens, because there'll be some people who will survive, who will have, you know, new ways of thinking, new ways of acting, new ways of eating, new kinds of immune systems, whatever it is that gives us those strengths that we need to keep the species going. And I think that's how we've survived on a changing planet in the past. It's how we'll survive the coming era of change as well.
Sonia, always a pleasure to talk to you on our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Sonia Shah, science journalist, author of Pandemic, Tracking Contagion from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond. We've been talking about her latest book, The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.